Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Today is January 22nd. Welcome, everybody. Let's start with introduction of committee members, because we don't really need committee rules to introduce ourselves. So how about, well, we have two newer faces to the legislature on each end. So which way, well, since there's only an empty seat, we'll give that time person time to arrive. That would be, yep. Representative Boschert.
Boschert Davis.
Boschert.
Mm-hmm.
Davis. Mm-hmm. Not Boschert.
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 Yes.
Boschert Davis. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to call you Shelley, but not in front of the cameras like I just did. Mm-hmm. Oops. Boschert Davis. Can you please tell us about yourself and your district?
Yes.
I am from House District 15. It was held previously by Representative Andy Olson. It's the Albany-Millersburg tangent, and I say the thousands of acres of farmland in between. Grew up grass seed farmer and involved in the trucking industry, and the and we also have hazelnuts and sometimes wheat, and involved in exports of agricultural goods mostly to Asia as well.
So
that's my background.
Do you have out towards Lebanon on River Road too?
No, not on River.
That's where my family, the self-proclaimed strawberry kings of Lynn County, the Clem brothers, had their farm like in 1892.
Hence the strawberry parade in Lebanon.
They claimed they were the strawberry kings, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Who else do we have down here?
Oh, hi. Hi, it's nice to be back. Ken Helm, represent House District 34. That is Northern Beaverton, West Haven, West Slope, and Cedar Hills, with a little bit of Portland in there. I'm happy to be back on this committee after one session delay, I guess.
Yeah, well, maybe two. I don't even remember now. It's 2013 or 2015.
Yeah.
Although we lost some jurisdiction or gained some, I can't remember. I don't think we had ag at that time. I think it was land use and water and rural communities, maybe.
Yes.
Something like that.
We did great things.
That's correct. Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Bill Post from House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and a very agricultural district, one of the best. And so, yeah, it's great to be back together again, and let's see what we can get done.
All right. Other Vice Chair.
My name is Susan McLean, and I'm from House District 29. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian and was raised on a dairy farm for the first 7 years of my life, and then went to a different type of farm over in the Clackamas County area where we had mainly livestock. We had broccoli and green beans and some crops on the first farm. And I love ag and natural resources, and that is now ag and land use as a committee. And this will be my fifth year. And I guess we're in our third term.
That is correct. And we don't have our empty seatmate yet. And so, but I see some tea there, so we might. We might.
I think he's coming.
Okay. Representative Williams.
Hi, I'm Ann Williams. I represent House District 52, which includes all of Hood River County, Clackamas County, down to Sandy and East Multnomah, where there's a lot of nurseries and other agricultural industries. I'm also particularly interested in the land use component of this committee, living in the National Scenic Area and struggling with some rural housing issues across my district in a variety of different ways, and land use will have a significant impact on how we work to resolve those.
And I'm Brian Clem. I represent where we're sitting now, urban Salem, which is weird then that I would want to chair agriculture. But as Representative Williams knows, I used to be part owner with my wife of an orchard in her district, but we sold our piece of it to our cousins a year or two ago. So now I don't have to declare conflicts of interest and all this stuff anymore. It's fantastic. But I'd certainly had literally my time in the spray room, checking on our chemicals and MSDS sheets and being on a tractor and knowing every law there is to know about labor and about all the other things that agriculture has to deal with. And so I think that's why I got this gavel. Though I will say, I have asked for several sessions in a row to try, if we're gonna have the committee split up, to keep agriculture and land use together, because lots of times the land use system either seems like just an infringement on private property rights to some people, or it seems like a way to somehow limit growth and economic development. And for me, at least, the reality of, from the agricultural side, the land use system was put in place originally by a bunch of farmers who were worried about competing with developers on the price of land, and then also the conflicts that occur if you have a lot of urban people building all their dream view houses right next to real farms. And so I like the land use systems component that tries to make it easier for agriculture to have a working landscape. The challenge then, of course, is you got to make it really very easy to build inside the urban growth boundary, and that's not always the case. So our goal here, I think, will be to find consensus on lots of these issues and not let the land use system sometimes turn into what it's turned into, which is a hassle for private property owners and too difficult for municipalities, but still protect the part that's core for farmers, which is lower cost land and less conflict from neighbors who freak out about your tractor at 5:30 in the morning, like this guy used to always come and scream at me about. And I said, why are you renting a house in the middle of an orchard and then yelling at me because I'm on the tractor at 5:30 in the morning? Maybe you could move because you're just a renter and you're paying $100 a month for a reason, which is you're in the middle of an orchard. Not that I have personal beef about anything. So anyway, that's my deal, and I'd like to welcome all of you. When I saw my committee list, I was thrilled, without exception, Post. I really was genuinely happy to have all of you. Oh, sorry. So having said that, we do have to have rules. I don't really like rules. I prefer chaos, but someone told me I have to adopt some rules, otherwise we can't do anything. So if there's somebody out there who would like to move some adoption of some committee rules, I would unfortunately have to accept that, and we would have to move forward. So,
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 22nd, 2019.
Vice Chair McLean moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 22nd, 2019. Is there any discussion about the rules? This may or may not be your first committee where we've adopted rules. These match the House rules that were agreed to the other day. Okay, any objection? Seeing none, the committee rules are adopted. And my little crib sheet. Let me open a work session for the purposes of the possible introduction of committee legislative concepts. Members, we do have a new policy or rule, House rule, that we probably just incorporated into those rules that say committee bills and committee amendments will have a sponsor by either name or group that requested them on the bills. So right now that's not on here, but I will be responsible to make sure by rule that that gets listed. For now, some of them I actually don't know if the groups who asked for them want their names on them. So I'm saying to you, I'll put my name on all of them, unless there's somebody else I can think of. Like Outdoor Mass Gatherings was a Thousand Friends and maybe Thousand Friends Farm Bureau bill, but I don't know if they want their name on them or not. So I'll put my name on them. If any of you are curious who asked me to and I can't remember who it was at the moment, I'll figure it out and tell you. If I can remember, eventually I won't just have to remember. Someone will tell me, hey, this is my bill, can you please put that in here? Then we'll add their name too. But for now at least, I'll just put my name on all of them as responsible because they're committee bills. Having said that, just for especially our newer members, there is not a mandate, but there is a general expectation or courtesy that if you vote to allow me to introduce these bills as committee bills, it doesn't mean you like them, it doesn't mean you've even read them, it doesn't mean you'll vote for them. In no way does it reflect support, but it's a vote to allow for them to get into the legislative process, so then we may have a hearing on them, and then you can decide if you like them or not. But because you don't want to get tagged someday with, you voted to vote for the stupid bill of Clem's, or of the committee, I always try to say this right now, that a vote to introduce a bill is not the same as voting for the bill. And Bill, Vice Chair Post, would you like to comment on that to make sure you haven't gotten burned by me too many times?
The only thing I would say is thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the proper introduction of committee bills. we are in session and it's time to do committee bills. Doing it during legislative days in December was wrong. And sure enough, I was on two other committees that are no longer exist as they are, and I said, these committees may not exist as they are, so.
We do them right now, so that is not the.
Yeah, so we need to stop the practice, but that's for another day, but stop the practice of doing them during legislative days when we're not in session. So this is good.
Do we have any emergency clauses in these?
You know what? I don't know. I haven't looked.
What?
I didn't even know they were up.
Somebody at this table is a little concerned about the use of emergency clauses, yes. Nonchalant, and some of us just do it and then don't even know if we did it and need to pay more attention to that. Because I've been being educated now for like 5 years about mm-hmm. this. And I don't know if they have them in them either. So we'll check.
I will look them over.
I suspect you might. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, would you like to move? I'll probably get one of these and you get one of these.
Chair Clem, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1411, dated November 13, 2018. LC 1584, dated November 27, 2018. LC 1667, dated October 23rd, 2018. LC 1673, dated November 6th, 2018. LC 1710, dated November 9th, 2018. LC 1711, dated December 10th, 2018. LC 1721, dated November 26th, 2018. LC 1872, dated November 27th, 2018.
Vice Chair Post moves that LC 1411, LC 1584, LC 1667, LC 1673, LC 1710, LC 1711, LC 1721, and LC 1872 with their various dates, as aforementioned, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills.
Yeah. Would it, if we go through these and you find that, you know, let's say I'm thrilled about one of them,
yeah.
I could take it on as a chair.
You could add your name on as a requester, but you can't be the sponsor because the committee is the sponsor. But if you want one, this is a whole new thing, I think.
Yeah.
You could kind of still get your name associated with a committee bill by having you be the requester. Kind of like being a co-sponsor to the committee.
Yeah, this is new territory.
Yeah, there's no reason you couldn't.
Okay.
Either, yeah, and if I want to take my name off one, you might want it on. Who knows? It's usually not, though, it turns out. Okay, anywho, let's get into our informational meeting, and let me ask Alexis Taylor and Lauren Henderson to come on up. And Lisa's just going to be available, even though she's usually part of the dream team. Oh, it's just Alexis. Okay.
One.
Yeah. Dream individual? I just got back from Iowa yesterday. It was cold. It was really cold.
It's colder.
Yeah, it's going to be negative 14 overnight and three nights.
Yeah.
Aren't you glad you're in Oregon?
Very glad.
Yeah. I won't tell anybody. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Alexis Taylor, director at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Like Vice Chair McLean, I also love agriculture, hence why I'm here before you today. I appreciate the opportunity to have a discussion with the committee on really the footprint of ODA, who we are and what we do, and then talk about the footprint as well of Oregon agriculture, and hope to talk some about the economic impact and really how important it is to the state. I'm actually one day shy of my 2-year mark on the job, so I can think of no better way to celebrate than with all of you today. It's been a very busy 2 years that I've been at the department. Being new to Oregon agriculture, my first year I decided I wanted to travel the state. And so I set a goal to go to every county in the state my first year. And I was very thrilled when I had achieved that goal. It was a great experience and I really learned a lot. And I enjoyed it so much I decided my second year on the job, I wanted to continue to travel the entire state and to get to all corners of the state. So I wanted to spend more time in each part of the state than just a really quick visit to each county. So we divided the state up into 12 regions, and I spent more time in each region, which was also really an invaluable use of my time. Since I know some of you are familiar with parts of the agency, and there are probably some parts that we do that not everyone knows about, so I thought I'd take some time to talk about who ODA is and some of the programs that we oversee. At the beginning of 2018, ODA completed a two-year strategic planning process, which I'm really proud of. We revised our mission, added a vision, and updated our core values. We also brought in 7 key objectives that ODA will really focus on the coming years to ensure that we are serving the farmers, ranchers, agribusinesses across the state. So ODA's mission is to ensure healthy natural resources, environment, and economy for Oregonians now and in the future through inspection and certification, regulation, and promotion of agriculture and food. So what this practically means is we help farmers, ranchers, and businesses connect with market opportunities for Oregon agricultural products, whether that's locally, domestically, to other states, or internationally. We ensure food safety and provide consumer protection. This is a core piece of our mission that touches every single Oregonian, but often are the programs that are least known. And we work with farmers and ranchers on the landscape to protect our natural resources. For the first time, as I mentioned, we created a vision statement. I think about our mission is who we are and how we operate today, and our vision is where we're going in the future, and how do we continue to meet the needs of an evolving agricultural industry in the state. So our vision is the Oregon Department of Agriculture remains able to serve the changing needs of Oregon's diverse agricultural and food sectors to maintain and enhance a healthy natural resource base and strong economy in rural and urban communities across the state. So that's just kind of those 7 key objectives I mentioned in our strategic plan. So ODA has 38 programs that really revolve around this mission and this vision, and they're interrelated. As you can see, our programs are divided into 5 buckets, which we call program areas. And I'll walk through each of them and highlight a couple programs that some of you may or may not be familiar with. So first up is market access and certification programs. These programs help Oregon's food, beverage, and agricultural producers really successfully add value, sell, and ship products locally, nationally, and internationally by promoting and creating demand for products through marketing activities, inspection, and certification. These programs really help differentiate Oregon products in the marketplace, in whatever market they're really targeting. One program that we do this through is a program called Certificates for Free Sale. Essentially, what that does is if someone wants to export a product and they're going to a country and that country's importer, buyer really wants to make sure that they meet our Oregon food safety standards, laws, regulations, we essentially send a certificate of free sale with that product to say, yes, this product meets our food safety regulations in the state. Again, just giving that exporter, that farmer, that rancher, that business owner, kind of a way to differentiate their product in that marketplace. The next program area is the food safety and animal health programs, which inspect all facets of the Oregon food distribution system except restaurants to ensure food is safe for consumption. This protects and maintains animal health. Our state veterinarian is housed under this program area and ensures animal feeds meet nutritional and labeling requirements and standards. In a couple of our programs, kind of the label is the law. So the label says what's supposed to be in the bag, and we ensure that happens in our animal feeds program and our fertilizer programs, things like that. Next is our natural resource programs. These programs address water quality and natural resource conservation on agricultural lands, the proper use of pesticides, labeling and sale of fertilizer, among others.
One quick question. Back to that last one. The food safety, what's in the bag, was this like the whole made with love? Are you guys the ones who decide whether cookies made with love actually can say that or not? I've now forgotten.
So that would have been pre-mind.
Yeah, at some point somebody had made with love and they got in trouble. Yeah, that was us.
Okay, I'm kidding.
Okay, I think we fixed that eventually in some way, but yeah. Okay. Or the lemonade stand. I think they also that was somebody else. Different agency cracked down on the lemonade stand of the kids. We fixed that too, I believe, here.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Chair Clem. Natural resources.
Yeah.
So we do this through really compliance, monitoring, and coordination with other natural resource agencies across the state. The next program area is the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs, which protect Oregon's natural environment from harmful plant pests, diseases, and noxious weeds. They enhance the value and marketability of exported nursery stock, Christmas trees, seeds, hemp, and other agricultural products. Both on the animal health side and the invasive species side of things, we utilize something called early detection and rapid response. So we are working with partners, whether it's a network of veterinarians across the state or through our invasive species network, to identify something of concern, whether an animal disease or a noxious weed or invasive pest, to identify it early on. And then we as a state with multiple partners can either put up an appropriate quarantine so it doesn't impact the rest of the state, or take on an eradication program. And so we do that in multiple areas within the agency. One example of that, I think, which many of you might be familiar with, is around the Japanese beetle eradication program, which we have had been ongoing for several years now up in the Northwest Portland neighborhoods of Cedar Mill and Bethany. In 2016, we identified Japanese beetle having a pretty significant presence. And so over the past several years, we have been working to eradicate that pest.
One moment, please. Representative Brocksmith, first, before you get to ask a question, how would you like to introduce yourself like all the rest of us did when the committee started only slightly late? And then you have a question, my friend.
I got accosted in the hall.
Happens sometimes.
I heard in this building.
Julian.
Representative David Brocksmith, House District 1, which goes from Charleston around Coos Bay over to West Roseburg, down West I-5 to Cave Junction, and then back over to the coast, proudly serving those constituents, and an honor to be on this committee as well as the other Natural Resource Committee in the building, and look forward to working with all you committee members as well as you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your leadership, and welcome to our new representative. It's a pleasure to be working with you as well.
And we have another new representative over here, but you,
yes. Yeah. And then my question is, how much has Oregon Department of Agriculture spent on the eradication of the Japanese beetle up in Portland?
So to date, it has been approximately $4 million from lottery funds. When we took this on, we knew early on that it was going to be a multi-year effort. We have enough resources really to go out from a staff perspective, set traps, and look for invasive species. And then when we find a pest of concern, come back to the legislature to request funding to do an eradication effort, as we did in this case. And so we knew early on it was going to be multi-year, at least five-year, multiple million-dollar effort to eradicate it. But that value proposition, it became really important because, unfortunately, the Japanese beetle likes to eat what we like to grow. So wine grapes, some fruits, nursery stock, things that could have really widespread impacts on our agricultural sector.
Follow up.
And so would you consider, I'm putting you on the spot, Director, another serious pathogen and problem we have, of course, in my district is the sudden oak death issue, which we haven't spent $4 million on, but the new E1 strain of that pathogen affects Douglas fir, as well as another 120-plus species. Would you consider that a serious problem, especially with the quarantine area, the nursery stocks, and the forest, or what's left of the wood products industry within Southwest Oregon?
Chair Clem, Representative Brocksmith. Sudden oak death is a problem, and certainly one that we have been working closely with the Department of Forestry on, and certainly your office. I know it's been a high priority for you. And again, I think it definitely falls into our early detection rapid response model that we have, and is a priority to work towards eradication of the N1 strain, as you say.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that we probably need to, even though we don't have forestry in this committee anymore, we need to continue to send the message to ODF and the Ways and Means Committee that we have to spend whatever we have to on eradication of. It wasn't fun when just the nursery folks were hit. Now that the whole entire timber industry could get hit, it's really scary.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, because the governor's proposed budget does not have the 1.7 million that we were able to get out of the 17 and then subsequently out of the e-board in the 19 or 18 session for treatment. It only has the roughly 200 and some thousand for the problem.
Yeah, that's alarming. We need to continue to call attention to that. And I'm sure you will in the other committee too, but it's important that we not forget about that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And then last but not least is our internal service and consumer protection programs, which provide consumer protection and help to ensure fair competition among businesses while facilitating interstate commerce by ensuring the accuracy and uniformity of Oregon's weights and measures system. And they monitor the motor fuel quality program, so for motor fuel sold in the state. So essentially, when you go to the gas station and you buy a gallon of 92 octane, we have certified that you are in fact getting 1 gallon and you're in fact getting 92 octane. This program also provides laboratory analysis and technical support to our regulatory programs at ODA. It also administers programs dealing with the wolf depredation compensation program and the egg-laying hen cage space program. So that's a little bit of what we do. As I mentioned, we have 38 programs, so it would take more than the time we have allotted today to talk about all of them, but just wanted to give you a snapshot of maybe some of the programs that we administer that don't always get all of the attention and the headlines. And I wanted to give you a snapshot of where we are in the state. This is kind of the footprint for ODA, where our staff is. About over half of our staff are outside of our Salem headquarters in the field. So they work out of home offices, they're doing inspections. And this really helps us cement ourselves in the communities that we're serving. Also, hopefully, allows us to be really timely and responsive to issues from the sector that arise. We do have some office physical office structures outside of Salem as well. I think of Bend, where we have multiple programs, and so we have staff located in an office there, but many of our staff are actually just based out of their homes. ODA has 375 full-time positions, but during the year, we also bring on many seasonal workers, particularly in our invasive species program, but also in our shipping point program, which are our commodity fruit and veg programs. So as you heard our vision statement, ODA continues to strive to really be a nimble organization and to serve the needs of Oregon agriculture as it evolves and the needs evolve. One example I wanted to highlight of this is a partnership that we have undertaken with the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, or NASDA, their foundation. Some of you might know NASDA represents all the directors, secretaries, and commissioners of agriculture in all 50 states and four U.S. territories. Their foundation supports education and research to connect farmers to new markets, inspire changes across the supply chain, and preserve the environment while maintaining agricultural viability. So we've partnered with the NASDA Foundation and the Washington State Department of Agriculture on a Women Farm to Food Business Competition, which, here's a shameless plug, is open right now for women farmers, ranchers, and business owners to apply in for the end to the end of the month. Why would someone want to apply? Well, we have $40,000 worth of total prize money that we're going to be awarding. Up to first place is up to $20,000. And this is for women to either launch, grow, scale up their agribusiness, their farm, their ranch, maybe bringing value add to a product. It's actually part of a larger three-part project that we're partnering with those on NASDA Foundation and the Washington State Department of Agriculture. It consists of a survey for women in ag in Washington and Oregon. Oregon, seeing really what their needs are. We've done some research around what types of programs are out there today to help women, but what do women, farmers, ranchers, small businesses really need? Is it help on lending? Is it marketing information? Then we have this business competition, and then we have a accelerator program that we're hoping to launch at the end of the year with, again, those partners. Really, the goal is to offer women who own or operate a farm, ranch, or food or ag or beverage business a hand up so they can continue to move in that marketplace. And I think, again, this is just an opportunity that came to us through my work with NASA and on the NASA Foundation and us trying to be a nimble organization to adapt to a great opportunity for women in our state. The department, as you've heard, is extremely diverse in the programs that we administer, and I think that's partly because we're diverse as a state in what we grow, raise, and harvest. Oregon has over 16 million acres in agricultural production, or 26% of land in the state. We have just over 34,000 farmers and ranchers in Oregon, and with the average age of the farmer in Oregon edging towards 60, upwards of 10 million acres, or 64% of Oregon farm and ranch land is expected to change hands in the next 20 years. The average size farm of the average size farm in Oregon is 477 acres. Now, if you're on this side of the Cascades, that could surprise some people that it's that large. If you're on the east side of the Cascades, it can surprise people that it's that small. Over 60% of farms are less than 50 acres in the state. However, while the majority of farms are small, the majority of land in agriculture in farms is about 10 times that size. 88%, to be exact, of land in agricultural production are in operations 500 acres or more. Over 96% of our farms in Oregon are family-owned and run, and we have a long history of agriculture in the state. We have 1,200 century farms. There's been a farm that's been in the same family and operated in the same family for 100 years or more, and 39 Oregon sesquicentennial farms. Don't ask me to say that word five times in a row. I actually grew up on my family's sesquicentennial farm in what I call far, far eastern Oregon, also known as Iowa. Nearly 40% of our farmers in Oregon are women, which is another reason I was really so excited to be able to partner on that Women in Ag project. When I'm asked to really for one word to describe Oregon agriculture, I think it's diverse. It's diverse in size and scale, who's raising our food, the production systems they're using, and then, of course, commodities. We raise over 225 different crops are grown, raised, or harvested here in Oregon. We're only one of the few, most diverse states in the country, and here you see just kind of our top 20 in commodities. There's a couple reasons for that. There's a lot of reasons for that, actually. But the two that I always come back to is really our unique and world-class soils that we have here in the Willamette Valley. And then also the diversity of precipitation that we get. It's always really interesting to me when you look at, you know, up on the North Coast, they might average 88 inches of rain a year. Here in Salem, 39 inches of rain a year. And you go to Burns and they average 10. So that diversity of soil types that we have across the state, the size of the state, and then the diversity of the rain that we have really drive the diversity of what we get to produce here. With all of that diversity and now having traveled the entire state twice in the past 2 years, it's become really clear to me how innovative we are as a food and agriculture industry in the state. Every sector really continues to look for better ways of doing business through innovation. For example, our tree fruit industry in Hood River are using optical scanners to look for defects for certain size and color of their fruit. That has resulted in really a different standard of quality that they have come to expect. So with that fruit being packed to a different standard, that grower or shipper and ultimately farmer receives more money per pack because of that consistent quality. The use of scanners also reduces the number of people that they need on the production line. And as I've talked to businesses who are deploying this technology, it's not that they don't need less people, it's that those people are now being redirected into different parts of their operation or to the field. Our row crop industry, particularly potatoes and onions, are deploying this technology as well. Another exciting innovation that I've seen on multiple farms across the state is around dairy robotic milkers and automatic milkers. I've seen them on a diversity of size in really from Vail, all the way up into Tillamook. Again, it increases efficiency in production and again reduces that pressure on labor. And then there's a lot of really exciting work out in particularly the Pendleton area around UAVs or drones for agriculture production and the use of pesticides or nutrients or water application. What I have seen kind of as I've traveled the state, this really excitement and willingness to engage in innovation to make us more efficient in our production systems. So I talked a little bit about the ODA programs, and I hope you got a sense we're a natural resource agency, but we're also an economic development agency. We wear two hats, and we're a little bit unique in state government in that role. The farm gate value from agriculture production is just over $5.5 billion. But when you look at that total impact of agriculture on the economy, it's leveraged to more than $50 billion annually, which represents 13% of the state's GDP. Food and Ag is one of the largest employers in the state as a sector as well, and it employs 326,000 full or part-time workers, and that's up and down the supply chain. And while the dollars and job creation ag brings to rural Oregon is really critical, it's also very important to urban Oregon as well. As I mentioned, you heard it in our vision, we're connected to rural and urban communities across the state. Multnomah County, for example, is the largest food processing county in the state. You know, as I think about the agricultural economy, so to have a strong Oregon economy, you need to have a strong agricultural economy. And in order to have a strong agricultural economy, you need to have a strong agricultural markets. 80% of Oregon's food and ag production leaves the state, and about 40% of that is leaving the country. Food and ag represent the third largest export sector, totaling about 11 or 12% of total state exports. And our export picture is just as diverse as our what we grow is diverse, right? We export commodities like wheat and hay, fruits, vegetables, and nuts like cherries, pears, onions, potatoes, hazelnuts, but then also consumer packaged goods like kombuchas, jams, and jellies, and then, of course, our world-class wines, craft beers, and craft ciders. But why does that matter? Oh, yes.
Vice Chair McLean.
I just wanted to ask this question while you're on basically talking about exporting. That, you know, I mean, a lot of the different items that I'm reading right now is talking about the fact that we left, you know, the 12-country trade pact. And that right now that there's a lot of things that the United States and Canada grow that are the same product, and that there was a lot of speculation within the last 2 months that it's going to be a different sort of picture out there as far as what we might raise next year. And I just wondered if you in your job with this directorship, if you have asked your staff or you have someone working on trying to keep up with that, because I mean they're trying to decide their planning schedule right now, and wondered if you'd gotten into that at all.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, thank you for that question. You know, I think when we think about investing in international markets, it's a long-term investment. I'll talk a little bit more later on about our top markets, but Japan is our number one food and agriculture market. And there's a reason for that. We've invested in Japan for decades. We've had a physical office for the state of Oregon. So we as a state, I think there's federal trade uncertainty going on right now, and that certainly can impact grower decisions, business decisions, but in the long term, again, these are long-term relationships that we as a state continue to invest in, help businesses make those investments, and I think, you know, regardless of what's going on, we're going to continue to make those investments as a state because I think it's critical. Again, 80% of what we produce has to leave the state, 40% has to leave the country. You know, the new NAFTA, the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Free Trade Agreement, has been modernized. Obviously, Canada is a top trading partner for us, as is Mexico. So I think there's opportunities, but it is a time of uncertainty, and I think that does certainly have impact. We saw it very clearly this year with some of the ongoing trade concerns and just our cherry industry. China's a huge export market for our our cherries, and by industry estimates, they estimate they saw $86 million in lower returns because of the increased tariffs that went on their products through their prime shipping season. So now, those cherry trees are planted and have been there for a long time, so it's about diversifying, and our perspective is how are we supporting those businesses to diversify those markets. Thank you for the question. So why does this matter? So a USDA study recently found that for every $1 of food or agricultural exports, it generates another $1.28 in economic activity. And I'm sure you all see this, right? A farmer, a rancher, has some business has additional money, and they make investments, whether it's increased conservation practices, new equipment, updating their irrigation systems, those types of things. Those dollars that exports generate trickle down to the local economy. Exports are also important to Oregon's economy because our farmers and ranchers are so productive. Last year in 2018, Oregon produced over 131 million pounds of blueberries. If we had to eat all of them, all of us in this room would have had to eat 31 pounds of blueberries, as would have every other Oregonian. Now, we can all make a run at that, and I think that's a give it the college try, but with that volume, because we are so productive, having those markets is really critical to agriculture, and you can kind of translate that to many different commodities across the state. So with Oregon's geographic location in the U.S. and proximity to Asia, as I was mentioning, I'm sure it won't surprise you that when you look to our top export markets, six of the top eight are in Asia. Japan, South Korea, China, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Taiwan. The other two is Canada, which is our third. And then I always find Mexico is our eighth largest market really interesting, because when you look at why, it's they're the largest fresh produce market for Oregon. So we send a lot of potatoes and pears to Mexico. Obviously, as I talked about with how dependent the state is on trade, some of that uncertainty that we've seen in our trading relationship is and has been causing some concerns. But we as a state are going to continue to focus on those relationships, helping businesses develop those relationships in really key markets regardless. So when this smooths out, and I believe it will, we're really poised to continue to be back in those markets, exporting in a really significant way in our key markets. I'm sure you've all heard by now, but by 2050, they estimate over 9 billion people will be on the planet. At the same time, we will have more people moving into the middle class in developing parts of the world. These two, I think, are really important to mention together, because they're going to have a direct correlation on what we look to agriculture to be producing from the United States, but also from Oregon. So we see it all over the world. When someone moves into the middle class, one of the first things that they do is they look to diversify their foodstuffs. They look for high quality, safe food products. Things like fresh fruits and vegetables, protein sources like dairy, meat like beef, things we actually excel at producing here in Oregon. Now, when you look at the developed world like the United States, we'll stay, our middle class stays relatively stable in the coming decades. But by 2030, 66% of the world's middle class will live in Asia. So with our proximity to Asia, with some of our top markets in Asia, and with that demand for really products that we're excelling at producing, there's a lot of opportunity there. Japan, as I mentioned, is our top market, and we're going to continue to focus there because it's really critical. But we're also looking at other exciting markets in Asia. Countries like Vietnam and Malaysia both have populations, very young populations, 40%. Of their populations are 25 years old or younger. So what does that mean? It means if we picked one of those markets today to really focus on, we could build lifelong Oregon consumers. We can build that brand recognition that we've spent several decades building in Japan. China is also on pace to add 160 million middle class households in the next decade alone. Think about that. We're just a country of 330 million people, roughly. 160 million middle class households. That's a lot of purchasing power. Actually, this is one of the reasons why last May I led a trade mission to Shanghai, China, with 25 other Oregonians, really across the food and beverage and agriculture sector, to have conversations, work on some of those relationships, because there is so much opportunity. It's a challenging time today in trade, but ODA and the state is really committed to continuing our long-term investment in these critical markets, whether they're local, regional, or international. And that economic side of ODA's house is really important to us as an agency as well. I think with that, I will wrap up. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk a little bit about who ODA is, what we do, and the importance of Oregon agriculture to the entirety of the state. And I look forward if there's any additional questions.
Yeah. Okay, committee members, we've got some time for questions. We also do have one agency bill that they would like to talk about coming up after this. So let's do questions about the presentation. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit off topic, but I found myself trying to remember from my time in the Natural Resources Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the basic breakdown of your budget. How do we pay for the good work that you do?
So we get all various fundings available to us. So we certainly get some general fund. The majority of our budget comes from other funds, so fees. We also get some lottery funds, mainly around our water quality, some of our noxious weed work. And then we also have some federal funds. We can certainly provide that exact breakdown. We have it to the committee, if that's of interest. But so basically, as complicated as any state budget agency budget could be, ours is.
Okay. That would be helpful, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Representative Brocksmith?
Just a comment, because I appreciate all the work that ODA and you, Director, have always been very open and coming and speak to me in my office, especially when with regards to sod and the unique quarantine situation that you have enabled our situation with regards to not quarantining the whole county, but having a partial quarantine, which, as we know, if we quarantine the whole county, then we have problems with it, especially international shipping and exports with adjacent counties, which would devastate the South Coast even more. So I appreciate all the work and effort in those areas and what you do for the state.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair McClain.
If it's appropriate, I would like to ask if we can allow Representative Brocksmith to be able to vote on the rules.
Do that. So, Alexis, you're going to be here for the bill too, the next bill.
Chair Clem, Assistant Director Lauren Henderson will be here for that, along with our Program Director.
So, while you exit, Lauren, you come up. We're going to do a little piece of House business or committee business here. Please, Madam Vice Chair.
Okay. So, I request a unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to. Okay. You have to say this. Okay. All right. Be recorded so that Mr. Brocksmith can be recorded as voting for the rules. It will not change the outcome of the vote.
Moves for unanimous consent without objection that the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Brocksmith to vote on the adoption of the committee rules. Any objection? None. Seeing none. So approved. Representative Brocksmith, how do you vote on the adoption of committee rules?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. And Lauren and this gentleman are going to tell us what this bill is all about and who he is.
Good afternoon. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture and have been there for a while. As Chair Clem stated, I have Isaac Stapleton with me, and it's my pleasure to introduce him to all of you. He's our newest program director. He's the program director over the Food Safety and Animal Health Program, so he's going to be my phone-a-friend when I get stuck today. We do bring you House Bill 2060, and it relates to our food safety program. And if you remember the org chart that Director Taylor put up, that was the second box there, and we talked about the made with love ingredient. You have a good memory there, Chair Clem. House Bill 2060 would give the ODA Food Safety Program clear and specific authority to condemn or close a food establishment for failure to obtain and pay for a food safety license as required by the statute. In addition, House Bill 2060 would provide a process to notify the food establishments that they have not obtained a license or that the license they had has lapsed, and that the notice would be given at least 30 days before any procedure of condemnation or closure would occur. Just as a little bit of background, our agency issues approximately 12,000 food safety licenses to food establishments to operate within our state. Our mission in our food safety program is pretty simple. Our mission is to help prevent the spread of foodborne illness. And food establishments are those really primarily not restaurants. The Oregon Health Authority and the local public health do that. So it's your retail grocery stores, it's your bakery, meat, and so forth. So with that, I will stop and entertain any questions.
We've got one person signed to testify, but do we have questions about this now? Do you want to hear from the other witness and then do questions? Representative Brock Smith.
Well, we can do it after, but that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a clarification for me with regards to how this process is going to work. So I have a business that requires the ODA licensure. That license lapses. You send me a letter and say, well, you already sent me a letter saying, hey, your license is going to lapse. You need to fulfill it. I didn't. And then you send me another letter saying your license has lapsed and you need to fill it, or we're gonna basically condemn your business. Is that pretty much how it's gonna go? And then you're gonna have 30 days until for me to respond, and if that doesn't happen, then the condemnation procedures begin. Is there an out there once I finally, you know, was on vacation and then checked the mail and went, oh.
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, your very quick description is pretty close. I think one of the things, and I just wanted to make one point, we are continuing to inspect those food establishments even that don't renew their license. We do that for the concerns around food safety, but really this is about, and we can condemn those establishments if they have a food problem. So if something is gone bad or there's some sanitation issues, our staff today have authority to do that. This is about the authority to actually close the facility because they have refused, in most cases, our continual attempts that have gone years to get them to be like every other 12,000 of those licenses to get that piece of paper and pay that fee.
Thank you for clarifying that.
What is happening right now as we speak, because this hasn't passed? What's going on right now? Is there, when they don't meet the guidelines and they haven't reissued or haven't re-upped the license, is there a notice posted? Is there, how does the general public at this point right now notice if that has lapsed? And so there's a reason, I'm assuming, that we're that you're coming to the legislature to get something changed. And so what's going on with those businesses right now?
Chair Clem, Representative Bossart Davis. So currently the practice is if a firm has failed to renew and they're delinquent, we send out those notices as was described. We continue to follow up with them through phone calls and emails. And when those are exhausted, we've recently initiated using an expedited enforcement offer for these firms, basically laying out what their back license fees are and their late fees and asking them to come into compliance. We do have civil penalty authority, which that we then could exercise. But so that's kind of the process now of trying to walk them through into that compliance step. There's no...
One second. Was it Isaac?
It is Isaac.
Oh, thank God. I was going to call you my dear friend. You have to say your name for the record because I forgot already. I got Isaac.
Yes. Thanks.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yes. Okay, sorry. Go ahead. Well, who are you again?
For the record, Isaac Stapleton.
Oh, yeah. Isaac.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sorry. Thank go you. Ahead.
No. So at this point, there's no notice that goes on the front of the store. You can contact the department and we can tell you if a firm is currently inactive in their licensing. But there's no notice on the door at this point. There's a process that we use to try and bring that firm into compliance if we can, but there's no notice.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Approximately, do you have a number of how many businesses or institutions currently that are maybe out of compliance, or percentage of the businesses that you're looking at, either or?
So Chair Klim, Rep. Bossart, Davis. So currently, we have approximately 600 firms who are inactive in our licensing, which I think if you do the numbers, it's roughly 10%-ish of our firms.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, to follow up a little bit on that, so you have 600 that are out of compliance, and right now you have an ability to continue some kind of action. But I think what you're saying then is that you feel like unless you say we're going to close your doors, that they're not going to make changes with the present system. Is that your analysis?
Yeah. So Chair Klim, Representative McLean, this bill would give us, without a doubt, the clear authority to close the facility. Okay. We need to take this tool, if it were to pass, along with our civil penalty tools, along with all the other notices, so that we can get the compliance for that. It is really unfair for a business to be able to operate, in some cases, for 3 or 4 years, even though our staff are visiting them, and their neighbor across the street has done everything they need to do to pay their license fee and cooperate. And that's what we're trying to correct. I don't envision our agency using this tool right off the get-go. We will use the other tools. But frankly, if they're not willing to pay their license fees, our license fees are anywhere from $26 to $1,600, they're probably not going to pay their civil penalty. And I'll just leave it at that.
My follow-up
was just, other than an equity question, it sounds to me like you're dealing only with bad actors. And the one other question that I had was, if they're going to get their license again, then, or get it, you know, updated or whatever, they have to go through the criteria to be able to have a license for that business. So you're also working on quality, not just procedure.
Chair Klim, Representative McLean, that's correct. There's obligations to have that license. And as I had stated before, we have made the policy decision to continue to send our staff in those facilities because consumers are still going in there because we haven't closed the facility, and we want to make sure that those consumers are not in some unsanitary or the reason. Okay. I stop short of saying that everyone is unlicensed is running a bad facility. That's not quite the case, but it really is to level that playing field for people. That license and paper means something, and it has obligations that are attached to it.
In one quick second, Brocksmith and Post, let me follow up on something you just said. In some cases, if I remember right, I've been here a while and I tend to blur things together, the legislature has specifically went in and exempted people from licensing, like commercial kitchens or maybe small scale poultry. So we've consciously made a choice. You can inspect, but don't license those. That's not who we're talking about. We're talking about people, if I'm even remembering right, that we exempted people from licensing.
Right. Chair Klim, yes, there are some exemptions, but for the most part, we're not inspecting those folks either because they're exempt.
Yeah. I think a couple times we said, let's inspect them anyway, but no licensing fee because they were just getting started and we were worried about the cost. But we've consciously chose that. That's not who we're talking about here. Yeah.
Chair Klim, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Brocksmith and Vice Chair Post.
No, just a comment. You already mentioned it, and I appreciate the question, Representative, that brought it out. Is you have bad actors that are it's not fair to the law-abiding businesses in the state that are paying these fees and following the law. And thank you and for your department for continuing to protect the citizens by inspecting. And you obviously need this tool to finish the work. So,
Vice Chair Post.
Well, thank you, Chair Klim. First of all, I think it's fascinating that this bill made the front page of the newspaper the other day. Of all the bills in this building, this bill made the front page of the newspaper. But it brought to me the question that was brought up about how many, and it was around 600, as the newspaper said. But it immediately triggered a question in my mind when I reread the story again and some of what you guys have said. That's 600 that you know of. Am I missing something? Could there be 1,700 and there's only 600 that you know of? How are you determining who the 600 are when there might be 1,500 others? Does that make sense?
So, Chair Klim, Representative Post, though typically the 600, I would guess the majority of those, and Isaac helped me, have a historical no pay pattern, some of them 2 or 3 years. I think currently for this year, we're at about less than 100. Is that right, Isaac?
For
that have unpaid for this renewal?
No, sorry. So,
introduce.
Chair Klem, Representative Post. So the 600 that's there, those are firms who have had a license with us previously and failed to renew. So it's not firms who have ever failed to get a license and we're unaware of. We're a complaint driven in that department. So if we don't know about them, we don't know to contact them and get them licensed. So this 600 is the 600 that have previously had a license with us.
Okay.
Of that 600 that is there, 500 are about this current calendar year. The other 98 are multiple year offenders.
Okay.
So generally speaking, that 500 we usually get pretty close to resolved on a calendar basis. It's those minor folks down at the bottom end of like the 98 or 89 folks that are multiple year offenders.
So this is more egregious than just never having registered or.
Yeah. So okay. If I could, Chair Klem, Representative Post, you bring up an interesting point. Part of our process, when we see folks that have not registered again or renewed, our staff will go out, one, to make sure maybe they're not in business anymore. So we do those validation checks. This group that we're talking about here, though, the inspector has gone out in their area. Our inspectors live and work in the areas that they do, and then they find out, yeah, they're still in business and should have a license, and they did not renew it.
So I think what would make me feel comfortable, I think, of course, we all like to think that there's we're always on the side of logic and common sense, but I tend to have a skeptical, healthy skepticism of government. And so I would want to make sure the infrastructure that you're describing is already current practice is in the bill. Like, not just you can do it, but you can do it after you've already checked on it 3 times, or you can do it after they failed to renew 2 times. Just write it in there so your current practice you already do is codified. So if all you nice people leave and somebody else wants to come in and just shut everybody down, they still have to follow the steps you're already doing, because that's the only part I see not in here. It's X, Y, and Z have taken place, and now they're still in this noncompliance, then you can do more. Then I would feel better, personally. Not that it matters, because they probably outvote me if we just call for a vote, but I would like to at least continue talking about how to get that kind of amendment drafted.
Chair Klem, we'll go back and see what that looks like.
Further questions? Why? Because you can't just have the first bill be easy. Well, you know, it's just the way it is. I wanted it that way. I was going to do farm to school, and then I didn't line anybody up, and so we can't really do that. Okay. No further questions. Let me call up the next witness on this one. Sean Miller, Northwest Grocers, please join us. Really good soccer player, it turns out. Really good. Like, really, really good. Just, or used to be, at least, at one point. I don't know.
Oh, hi. What's going on?
Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association, and we are in support of House Bill 2060. Good discussion today. We do feel that it is really just after the bad actors. I do serve as co-chair of the Food Safety Advisory Committee. I know my industry and others feel, and we share ODA's vision for food safety, as you heard from the last panel. And, the bill itself, a lot of the questions that were discussed today, I think to Representative Brocksmith, Representative McLean, and the chair's questions on process are the things that we really talked about in that Food Safety Advisory Committee, and obviously feel very comfortable with the bill, but understand you want to understand that process better. So, I think it's just giving the tools to address those bad actors, and I know some of those folks have been out in operation over a year, so they're continuing to get inspected. They know they're in business, and yet they won't pay their bill, and all my members are paying, as well as the rest of the ag sector is paying their bills. And so again, from a level playing field standpoint, that's really all this bill is after. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions for this witness?
I'd like to ask him, but I won't today.
Thank you. He loves gill netting. Okay, so let committee members know, I have no additional witness. Anybody else here who wanted to sign up on this and just forgot to? Okay. Generally speaking, my habit is to do public hearings and work sessions on different days so you have time to stew on things. Sometimes maybe we can find a reason not to do that if everybody's really excited about a bill, but Representative Brocksmith?
We can do that on my bills if you'd like.
Yeah, all your bills can just happen immediately, right? Yeah. Better count some votes, son. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2060, and I will carry over House Bill 20. That's going to take longer to get my little step-by-step, or you're going to try and convince me we don't really need step-by-step, aren't you, Lauren? I'll carry over 2060 till Thursday, just in case. And anything else for the good of the order?
Can I ask a question?
Vice Chair, of course.
Well, how many bills was the final count that we have coming our way?
That's a good question. Do you know yet?
35 right now?
35.
Oh, it's only the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we divvied up the natural resource bills between three committees instead of two, we're still occasionally looking at rebalancing workload. If they all, you know, somebody gets way out of whack, there's one of the chairs is sitting right here. He's in the same meeting I am. We kind of talk topics and then we talk workload. So we might be ahead or behind natural resources and energy and the environment, and then we'll probably rebalance a little bit so nobody gets overwhelmed.
I assume we're going to pick up some more.
I think so. But the funny thing is, typically farmers don't really want any bills to pass if they could help it, unless they got to like get rid of the Onion Commission because it doesn't exist. So like cleanup bills, sure. Otherwise, please don't pass any new things. So that part goes away. And then land use, you never know. Sometimes somebody on one side or the other gets very aggressive, and then sometimes they really work nicely together and form truces, and then it's not that many bills. Yeah, so that's always good too. So then we can just stop after week two and I'll have our time back, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I would miss you all tremendously. So with all of that said, is there anything else for the good of the order? We will then adjourn, if Laura will let me, adjourn the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Thank you.